Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank you all for being here. Thank the members of the committee for being here. This is the SMAC meeting. Does everybody have an agenda or seen the agenda? If so, then I'm going to turn things over to Andrew.
Thank you all for coming. I think maybe if we could start out and just sort of go through a quick introduction of everyone who's here, the people who are going to hear the recording, and the folks on the line, the folks who may not know everybody here. I'll start first here. I'm Andrew Button. I'm the head of the Conservation Replenishment Department here at VMRC. And Stag with is the director of shellfish leasing and aquaculture here, and Pat Gear is the deputy chief of fisheries management. And from Vince, we have Roger Mann and Missy Southworth here. So, and Jamie Hogg, Conservation Replenishment Department, recording over there too.
You want to introduce from left to right?
Tom McCallum, Weems, Virginia.
Ben Johnson, Southwark, Virginia.
John DeMaria, Newport News.
Lake Coward, Lossburg, Virginia.
Wayne France, Montrose, Virginia.
Ernest George, Waystone, Virginia.
J.C. Hudgens, Matthews, Virginia.
Heather Lockwood, Chesapeake Bay Foundation.
And Dan, are you on the phone there?
Oh, yeah. $10.
Okay. Don, you on there? Don, not yet. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew.
So I guess I wanted to sort of start with a quick update of the oyster replenishment plan. And then tonight, I think, you know, we have some seated discussion definitely at the end there, but I was going to try to save that for a meeting in the middle of August there prior to the August commission meeting. So I think that'll be sort of a full meeting discussion, I imagine. So the sort of focus of tonight, I hope, is to sort of hash out the James River seed quota, and I'll get into that here after a replenishment update, and then whatever time we have left, sort of get a preliminary discussion started on the oyster season, so we get some ideas floating around, but don't really settle anything yet on that, if that works with you folks there. So
sounds good.
Just to let everyone know, the shell replenishment, mainly the fossil shell planting, the house shell planting has already finished this year, but we're wrapping up on the Rappahannock actually today. So we finished there in Broad Creek this morning, late afternoon. We finished up in the Rappahannock. Before that, we just finished the Great Wicomico area there, so we planted Fleeton and Ingram's up there, and then in Tangier and Pocomoke Sound, we'd finished that the week before. Planted areas 9, 10, a little piece of 11 there in the upper Pocomoke, a little bit on Onancock, and then in Tangier Sound, we planted Johnson's Thoroughfare and Hurley's there in that area. So that's sort of the major replenishment program. The seed, we did move some James River seed from the Nansman Ridge shell plant that received a very good spat set last year. So we moved about 3,600 bushels of that to Big Bar and Honest Point there in the Macon River. So that went pretty well.
And those two bars will be closed.
Right, right.
Until the oysters are big enough to take.
So that was sort of what we discussed in our replenishment plan, establishing that rotational strategy in there. And it worked out that we couldn't get James River Hantong seed, but we had an alternative way, and we got some seed up there for a pretty good price this year. So that worked out pretty well. And we're planning on planting that area, Nansman Ridge, again this year, in hopes that we'll get a strong spat set there, essentially have that as an alternative for seed movement in the future.
What was the price?
We did it for $7 a bushel, dredge planted and overboard up there.
That's pretty good, long way.
So that worked out pretty well. Are there any questions on?
Sorry.
Are there any questions about this year's replenishment plan? And where we've been going? No? Okay.
Andrew, you say you just finished Broad Creek down to Rappahannock. Did we plant any at the end of the season last year there? Or is everything done this year?
Everything was done this year.
This year, okay.
Yep.
So we'll have 2 years on it before you reopen, right?
Correct. And we have about 5 to six barges, so 5-6 good days of planting left in the James. It should be starting tomorrow. So we should be wrapped up hopefully by the end of next week there. So that's where we are. And that's about a week behind schedule compared to last year, but we're doing a little bit larger plant, so, you know, not too bad by getting everything down a lot.
Those coming from upriver?
These are coming from just across from the Newport News shipyard there, from downriver.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that's the first time for there?
This is the third year we've been mining shale there, yeah.
Andrew, how's the larvae look this year? I mean, y'all have any way of checking that?
The fat set,
fat set
how
yeah.
it's going
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
It's been there.
We monitor the James, the pink tank, the Rick Comco, and everything's got set happening. Not
okay.
in great numbers, but
okay.
they're definitely setting.
Okay, good.
And they've been setting in the Great Comco since early June.
Early June,
and
okay.
And then mid June in the pink tank, and
mm-hmm. Yeah.
We'll see.
Mm-hmm. I know I've been seeing some pretty warm water temperatures, you know. I know up in my creek it was 90 degrees and it was 85 in the bay,
yeah.
so.
The temperature is
yeah.
running a little bit warmer than normal, and
yeah.
the salinities are running a little bit
lower
than
yeah.
normal.
Yeah.
So, but at least in those three systems,
okay.
they're setting. So.
Okay, good.
They're out there and there's shell out there, and it's just a matter of how much sticks, and we'll
yeah.
find out this fall. But
everything lines up.
Yeah. So that brings us sort of to the meat of the discussion, if you will. And so I'll kind of give you a little background, and then Roger, Mann, and Missy have sort of worked on a little bit of a paper about the James River seed that you have a copy of there that sort of underlines sort of the issues with the amount of seed that's been removal. So I'll kind of go over some background and then kind of give a summary of that, answer some questions if there are any, and Roger and Missy are here if there's any questions for them about that. And then we can kind of talk about the seed quota, where it is, where it could be, and sort of the issues with leaving it alone, adjusting it, that kind of thing. Works for you and kind of go from there.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just sort of give everyone some background of where we are and what we're talking about here. So this right here is, most of you I'm sure are aware, is the Hantong line. So everything downriver of here is the hand scrape area, and all of these areas, this is Rex Shoals sanctuary area. Everything up here is the seed areas and the Hantong clean cull areas. So everything currently is open to both. So this is sort of your Days Point area here. This would be sort of Point of Shoals, V-Rock. The sort of channel runs through there, and, you know, deep water light up here. Here's actually sort of how these are the areas that we actually sample. So that sort of is the open harvest area, those first shapes that I showed you here. And these are actually sort of the names of the rocks that we'll be talking about here. And you kind of see the shipping channel. Here's, you know, the Rex Shoals mark there. Here is the shipping channel. It sort of bisects Burwell Bay here, so Point of Shoals over here, you know, Swash and Mulberry over on this GL Island over here, to sort of give everyone a reference of what we're talking about as we go forward. So these are the most recent numbers from the James River seed harvest. So basically going back to about 2000 or so, we really kind of topped out in that period from 2000 to really 2016. We were kind of staying in that 20,000 to 80,000 bushels of seed were coming out of the seed harvest area every year. And really, and this is just for this year, this is what the call-in numbers when we established the quota call-in system, so we could monitor seed harvest as it was coming in, get an idea of whether it was picking up, and kind of keep a monitor on the quota. One issue that we've kind of realized is the call-in doesn't always match with mandatory reporting numbers. So you can see in the 2016-17 season, the call-in total was 76,829 is what was reported on the system. When we look back at what's actually reported in mandatory reporting, it's almost 111,000. So there's a considerable discrepancy there that maybe not everyone's calling in, they're doing it late, they're actually filling out the reports. So it's not a perfect system the way that it is now. But you can see that in the 2016-17 season, we actually got pretty close to hitting that 120,000 bushel quota for the first time. And sort of the interesting thing is that almost 100,000, more than 100,000 of those bushels were just caught in just the spring season. So that was really when a considerable amount of out-of-state demand picked up, and really there was a lot of demand for James River seed oysters throughout the whole Bay System, Maryland. Everyone wanted seed oysters then. So you can see that, you know, there's some differences again between the call-in numbers in the fall and the spring for that 2017-2018 season. 2017-2018 season. This is what our call-in numbers show, was 100,000, 125 bushels there. But what we have right now is there's a little bit of lag in our mandatory reporting. So we have pretty good fall numbers. So we actually ended up exceeding the 40,000 bushel quota that would cut off in the fall based on mandatory reporting. So we didn't close that season in the fall. So right now we have it split up 40,000. If you reach that limit in from October to December, we close the season and open it again January 1st for whatever was remaining of that 120,000 bushel quota. So what I have right here is this number, 111,000, is what we can, as of today, account for with the highest number of the call-in from this spring, which is actually higher than mandatory reporting right now, and the combination of that 47,000 that we got from mandatory reporting in the spring. So in reality, this number is, we may well, when all things come in, actually end up exceeding the quota for the first time this year based on mandatory reporting. So that's why we closed the season early. You know, we closed it a month early there. And I think it was a good call based on, I mean, in a couple days, we would have definitely gone over if we hadn't already. So that's sort of where we are on the amount of James River seed being harvested. this is just sort of, this is all of the seed and public and private seed harvest, all harvest coming out of James River. So basically this is every oyster since 2013 that's coming out of the James River. And you can see it produces a lot of oysters here. So this is market up top. This is seed on the bottom. And all things public and private, seed and market, you're looking at over 450,000 bushels of oysters came out in the 2017 calendar year. So that's not the season. That's just 2017, January through December of 2017. So almost half a million bushels of oysters are coming out of the James in just 1 year there. So that's just to kind of stress the value that this river has to sort of the oyster industry as a whole, because this seed is supporting, you know, not just public, not just private, sort of going all over the place. And a lot of markets are coming out of there too. So this is James River seed harvest. This is public and private. So there's a lot of seed harvest coming out of the James off private ground. I think many of you participate in that, and you're aware that that spat set that we get in there not only fuels the public side of the fishery, but it fuels the private side of the fishery in there too with that seed harvest. So you're looking at, you know, it's gone up a lot since just 2013. I mean, you're looking at almost over 200,000 bushels of seed coming off public and private in the 2017 calendar year. And this is just markets. So it's been, you know, a little uptick here sort of 2014, a little more 2015, and since then it's been pretty stable at almost 250,000 bushels of markets a year, calendar year, mind you. I know we kind of jump back between seasons and calendar year. This is sort of easier to put together numbers quicker like this. So a lot of market oysters coming out of there. So this gets just into the Hantong public areas right now. So this is just the amount of seed and market combined that have been coming out of on that map that we were looking at there, just those Hantong areas just off public ground. So just off public, between seed and market combined in the 2017 calendar year, over 200,000 bushels alone coming out. Here is the recent, over that same time period, the standing stock. So you can see after that 2014 uptick in harvest that we had there, there's a little, not a little drop, almost, you know, you're looking at close to 25,000 bushels down there. You know, it recovered. We had a very strong spat set 2015. pretty decent spat set in 2016. But you can see with this recent effort that the whole standing stocks of the Hantong areas there in the James have started to come trend the other way here. So this is really kind of an important number here. As you look right here, and this is sort of historically where we've been for the last couple, 2 decades really, is we really didn't get much higher at any point going back, 20 years, than, that sort of 70 to 80,000 range was sort of the peak, and there were some years where we're in the sort of 20 to 40,000 range. But really starting in the kind of spring of 2015, or the spring of 2016 through the spring of this year, seed harvest particularly has, skyrocketed. So between the spring of 2016 and the fall of, or the spring of 2017 and the fall of 2017, that's what this number here is, over 140,000 bushels were harvested in that one calendar year. So that last fall and that spring when over 100,000 bushels of oysters were harvested there in that spring. So that's a considerable chunk of seed oysters that's coming out of that area. So there's again for reference. And what Vims and Rogers were kind enough to put together is sort of what this current level of harvest really means to the resource. So kind of the takeaway is right now we're blessed with the James River, the amount of set that we get. So we're not really limited recruitment. So basically if you remove these oysters at this level from these areas, you're not necessarily going to affect the spat set this season. But really what the management, fisheries management concern is just a pure volume of seed that's coming off these areas. So if you take the, and this is well detailed in this paper here, so I'm kind of summarizing there. But if you take this level of seed, this volume of bushels of actual shell out of the river, really what you're doing wouldn't hurt the river on a whole river-wide system instead of that 1-2% range. But there's sort of a number of concerns that we have as sort of fisheries management and sort of with this. And one of those concerns is you can look at sort of a market-based approach. So we're supposed to take into account in our fisheries management plans the sort of best benefit to the Commonwealth of Virginia of the fisheries resource. So the commission and this group's advice to the commission is should be based on what the best benefit is, not just to the individual, but sort of collectively the whole Commonwealth. And it's sort of a, one argument you can make is sort of an economic argument that 100,000 bushels of seed oysters, if it's leaving the state, if it's going to private ground, wherever it's going from that area, that's at least potentially 100,000 bushels of market oysters that aren't reaching market there. I mean, you're looking at in a bushel of seed oysters potential, if you're getting a one-to-one return of close to 100,000 bushels of market oysters that you're transferring somewhere else. It could be someone's private ground, it could be out of state, but those are market oysters that aren't available in that area for future harvest. And that's, considerable. I mean, if you're looking at $10 a bushel for what seed costs versus, $40 a bushel for what market oysters cost, you're looking at sort of $3 million in economic benefits that, you're seeing a short-term gain there from the seed harvest and a, longer-term gain for someone else, but sort of the public fishery in that area is potentially missing out on close to $3 million of future harvest by taking that number out. So that's sort of one consideration that you can make for sort of the economic reasons for not increasing that. The other aspect is that although if you spread this harvest out over all of Burwell's Bay, Deepwater Shoals, that it probably won't have an immediate impact on the sort of total shell base, your future, your sort of topsoil, if you will. But the way that it's currently set up and the way our seasons are currently set up, that if that 100,000 bushels is focused on one particular reef, that can basically be all the brown shell volume, for example, on Dade Point. So if you kind of look there, sort of basically this level of harvest in some years pretty much would remove all the living shell on any one of these reefs up there. So if this effort is sort of focused, which right now it can be, there's nothing to say that people have to go here. It could potentially do some permanent damage to these areas and bring them below that sort of threshold where they can recover easily. So I'm sure you've all heard that replenishment department, we kind of have this 10 liters per meter squared target of brown shell volume, and we target that for replenishment. So if you look right now in some of these reefs, Days Point in particular, we're already sort of below that level. So there might be some spots that are above that, but if we get a couple of years of bad spat set and, you know, this level of harvest continues and it's focused too much in any of these areas, basically you could end up, even with a pair of hand tongs, just the amount of pure seed that's shell, basically has a spat stuck to it, you know, that counts as seed and it's leaving. So you could end up potentially damaging these areas. So if it's evenly spread out right now, 120,000 bushels, given our current level of spat set, is okay. It's not great. It's sort of the top end of where we could kind of safely be, given that we have our current spat sets. But if spat sets come down, you're basically, it gets risky the lower the spat sets get. So if this level of harvest was happening, you know, 10, 20 years ago, before the spat sets really started getting good in sort of 2006 on out, then we'd be in trouble. And we don't know that, you know, we'll go back there necessarily, but if we did and this continues and we're already at a low level, you know, it can kind of snowball and you end up in trouble there. So that's sort of one of the concerns there. So this, is there anything you guys want
to ask? I got a question I want to ask you. Over and over and over again, I keep on hearing about where you're dredging the shells is diminishing where there are none. So you're going to new areas to try to get some, and pretty soon they'll be gone too. But so the question is, in your formulation of these opinions and what's going to be there for the future, do you have you calculated the effect that those shells being gone from those reefs, why would it be any different for anything else? You understand what I'm saying? Yep, that's, excuse me. I'm sorry, I didn't explain myself properly. Like over off of King's Mill where they were dredging the shells to plant, and that guy was coming with that big rig and digging them down 30, 40 feet, and those are almost all gone, I guess. So you got a new place you're getting them off the shipyard. Okay? So the point that I'm making is those are dissipating, and there will be none at some point in time in the future. So why is it any different to have those being gone as it is for the other things that you're talking about right now? And have you figured out anything, how long they will last? Or
Well, you
understand what I'm asking?
Yeah, no, I understand that you're basically saying that they're both sort of finite resources.
Yes,
right.
That's correct, yes.
So the difference in this area is we can't build another fossil shell deposit
right,
like that.
Exactly.
Whereas if we maintain this area that we're talking about now with the shell base that's there, it regenerates itself. So this is one of the few areas that if managed correctly with hand tongs, not letting dredges up there, the way that we've been managing it, you don't have to replenishment.
If they're going on somebody's private ground in state, there's a benefit to the people in Virginia, but if they're going out of state, there's no benefit other than they get harvested by somebody in Virginia, I guess. So, that's some relevance there, isn't it?
No, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those that there is a short-term benefit to Virginia for harvesting the seed, but the long-term benefit, you're right,
is... is that something that would be, could be instituted, or is that to make sure that the benefit stays to our state rather than to some other state?
I should outline is sort of, I'm going to go over the options that we can take within VMRC. So any kind of changes like that would probably involve some sort of legislative fix. So we'd explored whether we could just say, nope, can't go out of state. And there's some interstate commerce rules that kind of get into that. There's potential for oyster taxes, but we've repealed our oyster taxes. So we couldn't do that within VMRC, I don't believe. So those options, you know, we couldn't take care of it. Yeah, I got you. So what I have here is if you go back to this map here. So what I'm about to show that graph here is these harvest areas that are sort of open. So this is James River area A right here, this whole big area that includes Day's Point. This is deep water shoals up here, and this is James River B, which is Day's Point. So this is sort of how we collect the harvest data there on this graph that I'm about to show you here. So this is the seed harvest by area. So this first column here that you can barely see in the 2016 number, that's deep water light, deep water shoals, that area up here. This is James River Hantong area A, which includes that whole big chunk that I've shown there. Most of the people that are calling in are reporting point of shoals. They might be calling some of those other rocks in there point of shoals, but it's basically most of the seed is coming from, you know, the Smithfield side of the river there. So on this side of the same side of the channel as point of shoals. So basically, if they're on the point of shoals side of the channel, even if they're on a different rock, oftentimes they'll call it in as point of shoals, but it gets reported as that whole big block right there. This second part right here, that's pretty much just Day's Point. There's a couple other small rocks there, but that's the other big place where oyster harvest is coming out of. So it's a smaller area, and right now, in theory, all of this harvest could be put here, could be put there, so it can jump around right now. But this is sort of the last 3 years, and 2018 obviously isn't up to date. These numbers will go up considerably, but this is just sort of as of today what was in our reporting system, not including the call-in. So 2018 will probably look very similar, probably a little bit higher than 2017 did here. So you can see when the majority of seed harvest is coming in, it's coming in from point of shoals, that sort of area. A few people go across. The concern is that the market harvest on Day's Point is the popular spot for two things. It used to be a popular spot for getting clean cull oysters markets, and right now it's the most popular spot for in-river transfers. So right now you can, within the James River, you can tong up seed, transfer to your private ground there. So a lot of the in-river transfer is happening from Day's Point, that area there. So that's potentially a concern there. If this is one of those areas where the level of shell is getting down there, and we should look at potentially limiting the seed harvest from this area and trying to spread that out to other areas. So that's something that we should, yep.
Andrew, what natural seed bed areas are they dropping in height, or are they staying the same, or what are they doing? You're saying this particular area, Day's Point, evidently is the amount of clutch that's being taken off is dropping in height, I guess.
Right. So Day's Point is showing a little bit of a downturn. It's relatively stable, and sort of but it's basically that if you get a bad spat set there, we've had the last 3 years really good spat sets, which has sort of been keeping us going here. Mm-hmm. But basically, we're removing almost all of that 20 to 30,000 bushels that's coming out of there a year is basically everything that's being put back. So basically, it's just barely keeping its head above water right now is sort of where we're at. And anecdotally, you can actually see in this next slide that the number of markets is sort of dropping in that area there. So the number of markets that are being caught in that area, there's not the same level that was back in 2016, in 2018, and it sort of consistently started to come down in that area there.
Do you have data where that stuff is being transplanted to, like it's going upriver or downriver, or do you have any idea?
I don't have hard data like that, so I can't say definitively that this number of bushels is going out of state, this number of bushels is today. I might be able to kind of piece that together, but the out-of-state demand is roughly 60 to 80,000 bushels a year as of the 2017-2018 season, and about 40 to 70,000 is what actually...
I think one of the things the state is missing out on, and I'd say this from the beginning of March to the end of June where I was planting shells and seed, I would in the mandatory report, I would put where I was harvesting from, and then I would also put where I was transplanting them to. And the people in the office, they did not like that at all. all they want to know is where it's being harvested. They said, just keep the record where you plant them to, and you can always look at them if you want to. But that's significant. Because, I mean, you need to know where the stuff is going. And they don't care. And you know that.
No, that is something that you know, for the argument that we can't make any kind of fixes like that, that would be a good...
Well, I mean, it's important.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's...
And you're talking about stuff going from one place to another, and you don't know where it's going, and, you know, that's important. It's important to the state.
Right, right. Well, we do have, I mean, in-river transfers, we...
I'm telling you, in the office, I've been through this with the people over there, they do not want any of that. All they want to know is where you harvest, period.
Right. Well, that's a sort of mandatory reporting side of things, and we keep track of it on the call-in side, and law enforcement does their best to keep track of it for the in-river transfers, because there's that, you can't...
Well, there's no problem with
that. Right.
The problem is they don't want to know where it goes.
Well, we're pretty good at track, or we are better at tracking it where it goes.
I'm telling you, they don't want to know where it goes. They don't want that.
Right. Well, that's, yeah. No, that's the, there's kind of different...
I'd have been through it every month with them.
So, really...
It used not be like that.
I mean, that's something we can take a look at. And
I mean, to me, it's just as important when you take seed from the James River and take it up to the Mob Jack or whatever else. Mm-hmm. I mean, you keep track of that. Why is this any less significant?
If it goes out of state, you mean?
No, if it stays in state. I mean, when you transplant, everything that you plant in the state of Virginia, you keep track of where it goes to.
Right. We do.
Okay, but they don't do that for the private people. They don't want to.
Oh, in terms of the private ground stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. That's a whole different discussion to have.
Right.
But I think it is important to track that and sort of know that too. But in terms of keeping it focused on this.
Well, I moved 100,000 bushels. I think it's pretty damn important.
Yeah, well, I got that tracked on our graph here. We know you moved it. We just don't know where it went exactly.
Yeah.
But, so these are those standing stock numbers there. And this is... Again, sort of the long, short-term trends of where we are here. It's kind of a busy graph, but this is the total seed harvest, or the total number of smalls is this orange line right here. This is the total of everything in the James right here, that top line. This is the total number of markets. You can see that started to trend down. So really since 2016, I mean, there's been some big ups and downs, but, you know, we're really, everything's kind of on a downward slope for the first time in a couple years here. So that's, you know, there's natural cycles, everyone knows, but it's one of those, do you want to act reactively or proactively if there is a concern with the amount of shell? And this is what I was talking about on Dave's point. So you can kind of see there's been some ups and downs. There was a little uptick based on that sort of 2015 spat set. 2014 was really when everyone was jumping into the oyster fishery. But this is sort of our 2017 numbers right now. So you can see it's, you know, the amount of markets just coming off Dave's point has started to drop off. This is total everything there. So there's still a good number of smalls that kind of make up for that market. But, you know, that shell base is potentially getting overworked. So really this kind of brings us to what we can do right now. So basically the major concern is if we leave everything as is, there's potential for, really the main concern is Day's Point and Point of Shoals, that those areas could have too much focused effort right now, and they could actually be, you know, potentially permanently damaged given a bad spat set and some of this effort. So really, there's one option is basically to reduce a quota level low enough that you could basically leave it alone. So you wouldn't have to split anything up. You could just say that roughly, I think we kind of looked at the number, somewhere in that 60,000 to 70,000 bushel range, you'd probably be okay leaving it alone. So that's sort of historically where we've been harvesting. That's about the internal demand in Virginia, and that would most likely, if our spat sets continue, be okay. We wouldn't really have to do anything other than that. Sort of a more complicated option would be to look at establishing individual quotas by area, sort of based on I'd have to work with Roger and come up with some good numbers on what you could do area by area. You could have this quota from here, but that would be relatively hard to manage given the size of the James River, the problems we already have with the call-ins, the thunder rolls. So that is an option, but it would be sort of a difficult from a management standpoint. Potentially a better option in that would be to sort of establish a rotational strategy for seed areas. So certain areas, if they reach a certain threshold, you could close into the harvest of seed. So that is a potential option, saying, you know, this area it's just going to be closed until it gets to 10 liters per meter squared or something like that, and you get a good spat set. So that's an option we could do. You could establish clean cull only areas and or seasons in some of these areas. So basically, if it's getting down to the volume where, you know, it's going to be a concern, there's still a fair good number of markets there, but you don't want an unlimited number of bushels of seed going off of there, including the market oysters. You could establish that as a clean cull area that would have the 12 bushel limit for that area per waterman, multiplied by the number of watermen on the boat. Sort of another option is to sort of stagger the openings, so you could divide up the seed areas a little more, and have certain areas open for certain months to sort of force effort, if you will, at least for that period, into those areas to kind of spread it out. Or probably the best option would be some kind of combination of those. You know, I have some ideas on that we can get into, but I'd kind of like to open it up to everyone here and sort of see what their thoughts are on that. If you want to take turns or sort of go from there, and I'll listen for a while and take a sip of water here.
Let's go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Andrew, why couldn't we consider an in-state and an out-of-state quota that a portion, I mean, your history shows it all. I mean, the spike was when Maryland came online with subsidized money to buy seed, and the growth and what's going on with this amount taken out sort of revolves around that Maryland effort. And several Virginia producers didn't get seed they wanted this year because of what had gone on. I mean, you've got a Maryland buyer set up in Tyler's Beach that started this year in October, which forced Virginia people that don't normally buy in October to have to buy in October. Is there a way to look at a two-quota system?
I haven't looked at that in depth, and I'd probably need to consult sort of legal counsel on that, on what we can do in terms of saying this can't go out of state, this can. So right now, we shall issue a permit for out-of-state transfer of James River seed oysters, I believe how it reads in the code. I don't know about establishing a quota on that, but we have to issue a permit if they're going out-of-state, and I'm not sure if we'd have the ability. I'd have to look at that, basically, if we could.
I mean, there's so many contradictions. You know, a Virginia producer, if any of these guys, if he decides he's going to buy seed, you know, he's told when he can take it back up, that sort of thing. This product can go to Maryland. They can take it up the next day and sell right back against us with our resource. And it's I'm not sure legal counsel is understanding just how this system is working.
What about time of year?
We can open and close the quota. So really those are options that we can have, is we can have it a shorter seed season. We can adjust when it's open and when it's closed.
So you could have a time of year for the people in Maryland, and that way the people in Virginia wouldn't be forced to buy it when they don't want it.
I don't know if we could have a Maryland-only season. Is that what you're asking, or a Virginia-only season?
Well, out of Virginia season, not Maryland-only.
Mm-hmm. I think that if that is an option that we have, I can make that ask.
That would address what he just said.
I'm to the point. I think we need a work group with some counsel, more than just it being on your shoulders, and have some sort of someone understanding completely what's going on here. I mean, Maryland doesn't allow what we're allowing. Every bushel I buy out of Maryland, I pay an export tax.
I think that's that's mainly for their tax system too, because they're still collecting an oyster tax. So I'm not sure if that's probably a major reason for that. They have to collect that tax there. I mean, that's not to say though that Virginia buyer couldn't buy the oysters and then their private property at that point and then sell them to Maryland. So it's one of those. That's the problem.
Is that mine them off the public? Or
well, essentially, that's what we do up there. I mean, is you know, the buyer, the tax follows it all the way through. I mean, we've got to get serious about this. This is to me, I don't know how anyone else on the committee feels, but you know, I got a real problem when we struggle to get seed in areas in the upper part of the bay on the public, or when any producer in Virginia didn't get the amount of seed they wanted this year. I mean, the way it's being bought out of state by tractor trailers, it's impossible for an individual waterman to compete with that. It's impossible.
Is this something maybe we could seek an opinion from the Attorney General or something on that we need to do?
I would, but I think it needs to be explained better than what it's being. This isn't an interstate commerce issue. This has the potential to crush our – well, we're seeing it.
Yeah. And years ago, and I'm not sure of the date, 50s, it was required that any oyster bought in the state of Virginia before it went – out of state was required to go overboard in the state of Virginia. That's why a lot of out-of-state entities purchased landing property as well as leased bottom, so they had somewhere to buy seed, put it over, reharvest it, put it to their landing on a truck, and take it to Delaware or Maryland or wherever it went. And if that alone would end it, and it would keep the Virginia resource in Virginia where it needs to belong. Not the majority of it, 80,000 of 120,000 bushels going out of state. It's not what, yes, short term, the watermen benefited from harvesting it and benefited that little bit of money that they made for a month or two or three or whatever they did. But that resource is held in trust for the people of the Commonwealth. And as you explained earlier, once that seed reaches a market level, it has a much bigger economic benefit than it does at the seed level, whether it be on my private ground, whether it be transplanted onto public ground, wherever it may go, but it needs to stay in the state of Virginia. It's absurd to have that resource and have it leave, and then compete against it when it does leave. I'm not sure. I have had a hard time finding it, but I know for a fact that it did exist. The piece of property that we now operate our business out of was owned at one point by Harold Dickens from up in New Jersey so that he could buy seed, plant it on his ground that he leased down here, have a landing to harvest it again, have his boats landed and put it on his trucks to send to Delaware Bay.
Probably what happened.
No, it's sort of, I think a lot of these questions, I don't have.
But at the same time, to go back to what Mr. Kellum said, if I buy seed or harvest it myself from October through the end of December, I've got to wait till January 1st to do anything with it. If I harvest it from January 1st through the end of May, I've got to wait till the 1st of June to do anything with it. And that restriction isn't even put on seed leaving the state. They can put it on a tractor trailer, run it through their house, pick out what they want or what they can do something with, put the rest of it overboard. So not only do they get the benefit of our resource, they can use it in a way that we can't.
Well, their export or their import permits do require it to be planted in Maryland and be overboard for 30 days. So if they're – I'm not saying they're not doing that, but – if they are doing that, then they're in violation of their own laws in Maryland.
And our regulatory process can't keep up with what's going on in Virginia, and it's following that through Maryland. I mean, it sounds good on paper, but it's a joke. It's a joke to have the resource leave when this is an industry that in Virginia was once the king. And it fell for many reasons, disease, that's a whole nother chapter in another book. And as it's trying to climb back up the ladder, it's steadily giving its competition the benefit. And it's not the way it needs to be managed.
Andrew.
Yeah.
What, so at this point, VMRC doesn't have the ability to regulate the out-of-state sale of seed oysters? Is that what you're saying?
I believe currently the way our regulations are written and the way the code is written.
I mean, the statute of Virginia don't give VMRC the ability to regulate out-of-state sale of seed oysters.
I don't believe that was sort of the Attorney General's opinion that we got in 2010, I believe, when we had this similar issue.
But it can tell private leaseholders that they can't harvest it if they don't pay a $150 user fee. $300 user fee, excuse me. Or own that user fee. If you own, you can own 10,000 acres of bottom in the state of Virginia, and if you don't have a measly user fee, you can't take it upon yourself to plant your own ground because that resource is no longer available to you.
Well, I guess my question is, though, do we have a mechanism to control what percentage of the oysters are sold in state or how many bushels are sold in
state? Somehow, time of year.
Somehow, somewhere.
I mean, from the public resource. Do we have? We don't have that mechanism at this point.
I don't believe so. No, I mean, we may be able to look at that quota system without getting into that, but I think I would need to consult legal counsel on what our exact option was.
I think that's important.
Can we just say no? It can't go out of Maryland or establish.
Because if Ben needs to plant oysters on his shore and he tones all went along, and the 15th of March we've met the quota, you don't get an opportunity to tone till the end of May to put oysters on shore. I mean, I would think that if we had the resource here and we didn't have the market in the state of Virginia, that we would seek other markets, provided the water, if the watermen would make a living in doing this. But if you have markets in Virginia, then it seems like it is self-defeating to not be able to utilize the resource in the state of Virginia, because when you do plant it in Virginia, not many people are going to plant long if they don't get recovery. They're not going to use their own money to plant their bottoms if they don't get recovered from that seed. So when they recover the seed, they normally employ a Virginia waterman to catch the product the second time. They've employed a Virginia waterman to catch it the first time as seed. They've employed a Virginia waterman to catch it the second time as a resource that can be sold for market. But, you know, we certainly do look, Tommy, I think you're on the same page. We need to look at a way to control the amount of product that may go out of state if we have needs for it in the state of Virginia.
Yes.
I mean, I think we're at the point this deserves a meeting with the secretary, whether it's this committee and you or something. I don't think legal counsel or anyone really has their arms around what's going on here. I mean, we're fighting a subsidized buying power that, you know, individually we're paying for ourselves, or the state's trying to pay for. I mean, you can't compete with them at VMRC, and, you know, private industry's trying to compete with them, and not only now we're having to compete with them on quota plus, price, and I'm all for as much as a waterman could get for it. I think it's great that they're making the money off of it, but when you show graphs like you showed and start talking about, you know, Day's Point having an issue, or, you know, at the end of the day, if we don't have the seed, Maryland's going to say, well, we just won't come get it, and we're sitting here looking at each other with, I think it's very serious.
It is.
I think there's, yeah, go ahead.
Hey, Wayne. I agree with you, Tom. I think, being president of the Virginia Watermen's Association, I get a lot of complaints from my members because they have difficulty getting seed to be able to plant their own private shore, you know. And I think every waterman would like to see the resource stay here, you know. I think, and it shows in the numbers. I mean, they make some money on the tonguing of the seed horses, but when you're looking at a $3 million difference in, you know, $4 million if it stays here and $1 million if it goes away, I mean, that's quite a difference in resource there, and the waterman would really be able to make it much better in that situation, I think.
And so would the state. Mm-hmm. You take that $3 million difference and use that 2.64 multiplier that the state likes to promote of what oysters do for mm-hmm. the economy, you're scaring $7 million that you're letting Maryland have versus us in the state economy.
Yeah,
That changes the ratio down big time.
Let's go.
Another thing to keep in mind is a lot of, particularly in the upper part of the bay, a lot of watermen have adapted into a small business. I had one, I know Mr. Harden at Purcell worked with one where they actually catch it, transport it, and sell it to you. And, you know, his argument was, I can't, with the truck and just logistically, I can't do over 100, 150 bushels a day. But I'm having to compete with folks, you know, with tractor trailers. You got a Maryland buyer with two tractor trailers sitting at Tyler's Beach. And, you know, I'm trying to catch mine and keep up. So, you know, the multiplier all the way through that is huge for the state. And enough said, but I think it's just short of a crisis.
So we need to, I guess.
It is a crisis for people that need them and can't get them.
It is.
We need to get some legal opinions on where we stand, what our ground is, and
well, so
where we can move, what we can do to move forward. So somebody needs to make a motion.
I move that we, through staff, contact the Secretary of Natural Resources and ask for advisement on where to go with this situation and have him employ legal counsel at his level.
We have a second?
Second.
We have a second?
I'm all in favor.
Lake is seconded.
I'm sorry. Yeah, Lake is seconded. Yeah. All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. Unanimous.
Good job.
That was good discussion, gentlemen. I guess we need to get back to this, what's on the board now.
I mean, that would change all of this.
Well,
if you took that factor out, if you took the 80,000 bushels that goes to Maryland out, then...
Well, I guess potentially that would take a lot.
It alleviates a lot of the stress that you're trying to work those five ideas through.
Right.
You know,
right.
There's another thing, too, that hasn't been mentioned. And when you plant all the seed, in 40 years I've been doing this, I've never had everything that I planted live. So, in other words, it might be 50% of it stays there as shell. So, when you plant all that seed, you're also planting shell, although that you would rather not be doing that. But that's just the way it goes, eh? So at least that shell will be staying in the state of Virginia for somebody's benefit.
No, that's. I think that we're all collectively in agreement that that we need to solve the out-of-state demand problem for a number of reasons. But if that demand still is close to that 120,000 acres, which I'm not sure it will be, but I mean, a lot of people who have private ground now are, you know, when. They worked it, sort of the private ground numbers are starting to come down again. So that demand, if it does get back up there, I think it still would be proactive of us to sort of address some of these issues that we have here. And particularly still that Days Point area, most of that harvest is taking place in state, and that area is sort of still an area of concern. On that map that I showed you there, you know, Days Point is, you know, folks know where Days Point is there. That area, about 20 to 30,000 bushels of that, most of which is happening in river transfers, is coming off. So what I'm potentially proposing for, you know, definitely look into what we talked about here with the Secretary of Natural Resources and that Maryland issue. But I think it's still important that we look at some of these other options there. And in case nothing comes of that or it comes down that we're stuck or it doesn't happen before the season starts, I think on that first season proposal that I gave out to you there, what I would propose doing this year is have just Days Point, James River, Area B there, clean coal only for this year. It's an area that's, you know, it's below that sort of 10-5 liter threshold there. Have that a clean coal area. See how it goes, see how it recovers. And then we haven't looked at it yet. We're going to get up there as soon as we're done shell planting the deep water shoal area. But if I go back to this map right here, what I would propose doing is in the month of October, no seed harvest the area of Dave's Point here, basically everything on this side of the channel over here, so Point of Shoals, this area, would be clean cull only for the months of October and April. And
so you're talking like V-Rock and all their places too, or are you just talking about Point of Shoals?
Yeah, V-Rock, like the whole everything.
Everything over there?
Everything, just for October and April, when sort of the peak demand for seed usually picks up there. October and April this year, have that clean cull only, then open to seed harvest the rest of the year, so that when that demand from out of state, if it's still there in Maryland, picks up, you'd be limited to seed harvest just in this portion of Burwell's Bay on this side of the channel, so including Deepwater Shoal State Replenishment Area. And we could leave the quota at 120,000 bushels, but if we drop it down to 100,000 bushels, that's, you know, it would meet, probably more than meet the demand here in Virginia if we kept it like that, and you wouldn't, it's sort of a cautionary step there, that 100,000 bushel quota for seed total and sort of splitting it up that way would sort of be an option that we have today that could address a lot of these concerns.
But that we really won't know anything about that until we get this other issue solved.
Well, I guess that's...
on a quota, unless, you know, you just plan on dropping the quota anyway.
Right.
But I do, you know, we realize that we need to protect these areas that are getting depleted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with all the fresh water we've had, we don't know what kind of spats that and how much more depletion we may get this year. But it's still open for discussions, Alan.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Andrew, does Maryland buy any fossil shale from the dredge here?
Not from us.
Not from you. Okay. I mean, can they?
They haven't.
They haven't, so, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, does everybody...
We can decide.
Yeah.
Since it's a state contract, we can manage that in our best interest, so we have the authority to not sell that out of state.
Okay. So the dredge now, we're buying all the shale from this dredge here?
Right, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So we can basically determine what they can do that. We can sell it back to the company, or they can buy it from us if we want, and then
okay.
we sell it out. But we don't have to let them do that. So that's a resource.
Any other comment on what maybe we should do? How does law enforcement, what's their opinion on having to monitor this and watch this with these different changes maybe?
I haven't asked them specifically on this breakup here that we're proposing here. It's one of those that if you split it up into sort of three areas, if you will, it would be more easily enforceable that way. You have the sort of clear marker of the channel, Dave's Point, and then sort of everything else. So it would be probably the easiest to manage it if we split it up that way from a law enforcement perspective. And from sort of a conservation perspective, you know, these are the areas that, at least reporting and sort of anecdotally, that most of the seed harvest is coming from. So.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
What if we've identified a section of the code that may help it? I think it's pretty open-ended as to what we could or couldn't do with it. But what if we defer this, and if it came right down to it that we're bumping up against the season, is it anything from precluding the commission to, you know, to change the season to November to give us another month to get squared away rather than, you know, I think it's a lot at stake to start.
Yeah, we could delay it until November, in terms of the seed season, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, we can.
Another thought I had, that as staff talks about this, we, you know, you passed a regulation charging individuals $150 a day to move polluted oysters. Are we in some sort of realm, maybe without a state seed, to be able to use?
I think we could have an out-of-state permit fee, I believe, would be an option for us. If that would, that right now it's a free permit, so I believe that would be an option for us.
I guess where I'm at, is, in just individually, my opinion, it's just so much on the table here and so much in the air that I'm not really comfortable trying to make a decision on anything else until we at least get some idea, allow you to get some idea of where we stand on all of this.
If it's fair for you and I to pay $150 every time we do that, why not for them?
And it's, you know, I'm not talking about, I don't know they're getting polluted oysters, but, you know, that using that sort of tactic
well,
to help
to have,
with.
Well, they have a guy sit there and watch what they're doing.
At least the state to be able to recoup some of the cost of law enforcement dealing with it. You know, it's cost associated with this that you would think as Virginia residents and Virginia companies, we're, you know, through our business efforts are lending to, whereas with the Maryland folks, I mean, when it's gone, it's gone, and it's a pretty sweet deal.
Yeah, it's a good deal for them.
But I just have a tough time trying to make decisions with this much in the air. I mean, thankfully, the commission had the foresight to put this $120,000 on, and I mean, most of you were on this committee then, and the whole reason we did it was Maryland was inquiring on Virginia seed then, and you know that's the reason. Thankfully, the quota went in place, and you know, you spoke earlier of the what we think Maryland's appetite for this seed is. I mean, I had folks calling me wanting to know would I be interested in doing. I think this has the potential to continue to grow. We're steady getting Maryland folks wanting. You know, it's sort of like the cat's out of the bag on this deal now, and it's they're having trouble with what they do with this money they're given, and this is a pretty easy fix. So.
And the unfortunate thing in some cases in Maryland is the individuals that are planting it don't have any experience in planting oysters, and I guess when their money's gone, they'll have experience in planting oysters. But, you know, it may be a waste of resource. And certainly a lot of us here in this room and in the state of Virginia have wasted resource, but certainly not intentionally.
Well they had big death rates up in Maryland, too, now. They had some places where they're still alive, but they had a lot of oysters die up there. Because I talked to Cool Ice about 3 weeks ago. Tom passed away.
Yeah. I mean, there'll be some places in Virginia where oysters die this year.
Yeah, well, I know about that too.
But
that's further up today there. They really got hammered.
If we don't have the demand for the product and we have the resource, it appears that it should be fine for it to go to state. But if we have the demand for the product and don't have the resource, then it does seem like a waste for the Virginia industry to allow the exploitation of a resource that is finite.
So, let me ask this question, Mr. Cullen. So are you asking for an extension on making any kind of decision on this today?
Yeah, I'm not looking to kick the can. Just looking to maybe allow Andrew some time to get some information that, I mean, I have a hard time setting limits and talking about changing structures when we could take care of this through what we've talked about earlier.
Right. I understand exactly. We're opening up a can of worms here, and we need to find out where these worms are.
Well, how big a problem would it be delaying until November?
You don't necessarily need to. Depends on when you can find the information out.
Yeah,
they can find it out and still open it in October.
Yeah, I mean, we can try to. I mean, I'd like to have another advisory committee meeting in middle of August sometime to we can address this again, so we can kind of.
I applaud you for bringing it this early and for getting this on the table where we've got time.
Absolutely.
Instead of 1 month before a commission meeting. I'm not trying to kick the can. I really appreciate you bringing it early, but I would like to have some more feel for what we do have the power to do.
I think this is very important for the Virginia oyster industry.
For a long time.
That's right. So, Mr. Button, where do we stand now?
we can kind of table this for now, I guess, if you want. We have some good ideas to think about. Got some homework to do.
Do we need to make a motion on what you're talking about on the?
We did.
I think if we follow what he's saying, table it and have a meeting in August and come back and
see
where we stand and go from there.
Yeah, I don't know.
He might like to have a directive.
I wouldn't think we need a motion to table it. We're just continuing it until we make a decision.
And I'm not trying to make more work for you. I just
it's very important.
I appreciate that.
All right. You still there, Dan? Might have Alice on mute there. He's not his. Oh, there we go.
Wake up.
Well, that saves us a little time to drink of water here. So now that I think that was some very worthwhile discussion there that we've had, and I appreciate everyone's input. I think we have not a clear path forward, but hopefully a path forward here. But I guess this moves us to our second agenda item here. And I really kind of wanted to get, again, a little early, sort of have some preliminary discussion, sort of hear feedback from all of you, and then come back again in August and really, really hash out this the harvest seasons. But really, what if I'll do a little reading from the code book here that I think is kind of important as we kind of think about establishing this harvest season there. And I don't think you have copies of your code books there, but I'll go ahead and read this just for everyone's benefit. And it's 28.2.203, which is sort of how the commission prepares fishery management plans and standards. So I'm just going to read that quick section for everyone to sort of have that in mind as we kind of think about where we're going on these seasons. So it says, the commission shall prepare and implement fishery management plans so as to preserve the Commonwealth's exclusive right to manage the fisheries within its territorial jurisdictions. Any fishery management plan prepared and any regulations promulgated to implement the plan shall be consistent with the following standards for fisheries conservation and management. So number one is conservation and management measures shall prevent overfishing while achieving the optimum yield from each fishery. The optimum yield of a fishery means the amount of fish or shellfish, that's us, which will provide the greatest overall benefit to the Commonwealth, with particular reference to commercial fishing for food production and the recreational fishing. So that touches on some of that seed stuff there. Number two is conservation and management measures shall be based upon the best scientific, economic, biological, and sociological information available. Number three, to the extent practicable, an individual stock of fish shall be managed as a unit throughout the territorial waters of the Commonwealth, and interrelated stocks of fish shall be managed as a unit or in close coordination. Four, conservation and management measures shall not discriminate among user groups. If it becomes necessary to allocate or assign fishing privileges among various user groups, such allocation shall be, one, fair and equitable to all fishermen, and two, reasonably calculated to promote conservation, and three, carried out in such a manner that no person acquires an excessive share of such privileges. Five, conservation and management shall, where practicable, promote efficiency in the utilization of fishery resources, except that no such measures shall have an economic allocation as its sole purpose. Six, conservation and management measures shall take into account variations among and contingencies in fisheries, fishery resources, and catches. And seven, conservation and management measures shall, where practical, minimize regulatory burdens which inhibit innovation, expansion, and normal business operations. So just to sort of keep that in the back of our heads as we kind of talk about the season here, I think will help us come to a wise decision there, if you will.
Well, just that conservation and optimum yield, that should give you a lot of parameters to do what we're talking about doing with the government.
There's a lot in there that.
Yeah. That, I mean, you said when it starts falling below that certain threshold, that you can start cutting things off of people getting product, especially out of state, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So that gives you.
Because in state, you get the benefit of the shell and benefit of the yield.
So that I'll just.
That's good. That's very good.
Run through this.
What's the number of that again?
28.2.203.
28.2-203.
So this is a graph that I'm sure everyone has seen, the various updated versions as you've sat here on this committee, and it's Jim Wesson. It's his original version that I've been adding to since I've been here. So I don't take credit for this major uptick. I just take credit for this little level piece here at the end. But so there's tentatively some good news, I would say, and that's that basically right now it looks like we're almost exactly the same, a little bit of an uptick from where we were last season. So the private side of the harvest actually was down. All the numbers aren't completely in yet, but probably down about 10,000 or so bushels compared to last year. Public harvest was actually up approximately 10,000 bushels, so it sort of balanced out. So right now, if spat sets continue, replenishment continues, we more or less keep the rotational strategy, don't make any major changes. I think we're at sort of a relatively stable level in the public fishery. I mean, like Mr. Marie is always saying, we're one hurricane away from bankrupt, and I mean that's always the case. But given kind natural events and continued spat sets and the replenishment effort, I think we can kind of more or less maintain where we are now. You brought up a good point earlier about the time frame and the limited resource that covers most of our replenishment, which is the shell that we're dredging. So estimates of how long that'll last range from 15 to 30 years, depending on if you find new sources, if you can get permits, and that aspect. So I plan on being here for, 15 to 30 years, sounds about right. But what sort of my goal would be in that time is to basically, we know that at some point we're going to run out of relatively inexpensive, cheap, if you will, fossil shells, and that I think it's pretty well accepted that a lot of the hand scrape areas, a lot of the areas that are dredged on, I mean, pretty much at some point require replenishment to maintain their current production. So we pretty much, I think it's well accepted that we have to keep replenishing, unless we're just get ridiculous bat sets every single year, sort of maintain the level that we're at now. So long-term planning, which is something we don't always do, a lot of times it's October, not October 10 years from now. It's something that I think it's important for me anyway, and I think for everyone here, that we should start trying to look at. And really the long-term goal that I have is to try to get the public fishery to a point in 15 to 20 years where we're stable, whatever it is that we're doing. So if areas get high-density oyster populations, it might be beneficial for us to look at potentially transitioning those areas to a less efficient gear type. I actually had a discussion with some folks up in Maryland, and they called it life after Langenfelter. So basically, their shell planting program more or less ended in 2006. They weren't really planting shells on a lot of their public grounds. And, well, now they're here buying a lot of James River seed to try to keep their industry afloat. And we don't have another Virginia 20 years from now to buy a lot of James River seed from. So really what I think the important task that I have and that we all have sort of collectively is to look at basically trying to get us to a high stable level as we possibly can in the next 15 to 20 years while we have this resource available to us. And I really think that the only way that we can do that in a relatively sure way is sort of when we get areas to get a phenomenal spat set that have market oysters, 10 or 15 per square meter, where you could catch 12 bushels with a set of tongs, the water shallow enough. Yeah, you can be back at the dock at 7:30 if you put a scrape on that, but you could also be back at the dock at 11 o'clock with 12 bushels from a hand tong. So it's one of those questions that we have to look at carefully as we go forward, is if, yeah, we can keep scraping, we can keep oysters coming in by 10 o'clock all season long, but is it really in our long-term benefit to keep doing that when we could have oysters coming in at 12 for 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, potentially for long term if, the spat sets continue, it sort of lengthens out that time frame that we have, and we could potentially end up at sort of a stable higher level when we do one day run out of shells. So just sort of, that's kind of long-term where I'm going. So I just wanted to kind of share that with everyone and sort of go from there. And then I'll just kind of run through this and get your feedback. But is there anything on that you guys want to
address? Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
You know, one thing I think we still don't factor in that's in a 15 to 30 year is the attrition of this aging waterman population. And we lost another in the northern neck, Ernie can tell you, 2 weeks ago, and he was sick on oxygen the whole year, and he worked 27 days, so his license is off the table. So I think we've got to think about that side of it in long-term planning. Honestly, that as a producer that buys from public resources, the mainstay of my business, the sustainability of the waterman keeps me awake at night as badly as the sustainability of the resource. And I think, unfortunately, we're gonna get our goal of reducing effort, and it's just that's going to be part of the factor. So, and a less efficient gear type with an aging population of watermen is a, you know, the whole way that we got to hand scrape was, you know, trying to figure out a way to make it a little bit easier. But it's a lot of dynamics, and I appreciate the long-term thinking and a strategy, and I think it's somewhere we want to get. But we, you know, most of these hand scrape areas that were patentong areas are producing multiple times what they used to produce. And it's, you know, it's a lot more to it than just, you know, the lower Rappahannock stayed closed for 20 years and we were foaming at the mouth to get there, and it was a big disappointment, and it's continued to get better every year. So I think we got to consider all the components to a long term.
No, absolutely there. And it's one of those that obviously the hand scrape dredge isn't going to disappear overnight, and for that reason, just sort of, it's very important that it doesn't. But it's sort of one of those, as that population ages out, if you will, and there are hopefully young people coming in that could potentially fish with less efficient gear, something that we want to try to incentivize and sort of encourage people to be, you know, true oystermen that do it all, like the all year cruiser piece of the hand on, the hand scrape, the back.
The efficiency of that dredge to be able to turn those shells that are turning brown in the mud versus the tongs that just skim off the top. I mean, that's a factor too. I mean, we use a dredge on our ground all the time, but I mean, there's people that will take a dredge and they'll ruin a piece of ground. There's people that know what they're doing with the dredge, and they actually enhance it. And that's what he just said about up in the Rappahannock. And that's something that you have to have in the back of your mind as well. But, you know, I'm...
Mr. Mann. This much area, not a lot of shell. You all know that that's what we're doing. And so at some point we're going to have to come back and discuss how we manage our seed in terms of the shell that's out there. Now, we're not in desperate straits if we look at this as just a Virginia issue. I mean, the work that Mr. Callum did, that he's never got enough acknowledgement.
stop in terms of what we need. I think what you sort of start with when you start down this road of how many limit stuff going out of state, I'd say, well, actually, that's not your horizon. The question is that's the first of about 15 different questions that you need to daisy chain all together. If you get a member of the Attorney General staff in there, you don't let them out of the room until you've got to number 15. It's not just county manages so that we keep it in state. The thing that Andrew read to you has got a very important two words in it. It's called optimal yield.
Yeah.
Wearing another cap, I sit on the Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council where we argue about lots of other things. Maximum yield and optimum yield are not the same. They're absolutely not the same. And just the same way that in your business, if you sell a lot of stuff and the price per unit goes down, you've got past optimum yield. So I think one of the questions that you pose here, which is what is happening with the aging number of men in blue fish, is think forward to if you can control the seed fishery, if you can control the seed fishery with a rotation that does not limit the amount of seed that you want, you can keep that seed within Virginia. If you can do that in a sustainable manner in a place like Eugene's, you probably can reduce how much money you spend on depletion. Where do you put that? And once you put it in some place, looking
good
at
point.
The aging demographic of all of the people that you put there, how do you design an optimal yield, the maximum yield, an optimal yield for all of those people and where they're working? You know, I sit in here with a graying population. I've known most of you guys for the 33 years that I've lived here, and I'm 66, okay? We're all growing all together. But the point is that when you make these comments about we should do this, I sit here and I daisy chain them together. What I'd like to suggest to you is that when you go on tonight and think about this, don't just think about, can I stop this going after Maryland? I think what you should think about is where he wants to be when he's my age. You have the complete capability to do all of that when you're optimizing the yield. I think that's what you need to think about doing. And I think there's enough smarts in this room to do that. And so when you think of that, the next question I would ask you is, what legal regulatory structure do you need to start to put in place now to get you to where you want to be when he's retiring? When you start the conversation about stopping just seed going out, no. How many pieces do you want to put in there? And we can do that. I think that would be something that would be well worthwhile doing. And quite frankly, before all of us old people retire, we should be able to do that.
Dr. Mann, thank you. And that's probably, you know, that's something that we all want. We want optimum yield, and, you know, every year we want to see our fishery in Virginia improve. You know, and I think everybody here thinks that that is a goal. That is our goal.
So I think we have a lot of thinking to do about right now, and I think it's all really appreciate everyone's thoughts on this, and I just wanted to, I'll just save the bulk of this for next time. There's probably going to be some discussion, but I just want to run through this real quick and get to the harvest seasons that I passed out there, and I'll try to kind of explain my reasoning for each one of those, and then we'll kind of go from there. So harvest season, this is, I'll go this real quick. So this is a question I get all the time that people ask, and I'm sure people ask you, and I just wanted to throw this in there real quick. It's what percentage of our harvest is wild versus aquaculture? And that's a hard question because really how we measure it is public versus private. So just so everyone is kind of aware, this is kind of neat there, and it looks like a peace sign. But anyway, so how I answered this is I broke everything down by gear type. So basically, on this side over here, this is private traditional harvest. So if it's caught with a dredge, a scrape, or a hand tong, this is just 2016 calendar numbers. That's the bushels that came off public ground, not in containers, basically. Right
off
there.
Private.
Off private ground, excuse me, yep. And that's about 41% of the 2016 harvest came off private, not in containers. And then public was basically the same, 237,000 bushels. So wild harvest. So I call this sort of private traditional wildish, because some of that is, you know, hatchery-based fat on shell included in that. This is all wild-based. But this number right here is what's considered containerized private, so that was just in 2016. So this is just something that I get all the time, and I'm sure you guys get too. So basically it's about 20% containerized and 80% wild, if you want to kind of call it that way. So it sort of depends on the definition. But
are you including spat on shell in that?
Spat on shell is included in this wildish. So
okay,
there's about
right.
40 to...
So what, this is cage culture?
Yep.
116.
Yep, that's right.
That's good information.
So I usually start putting this up when I give presentations, so I figured it helped kind of spread the word with that question. So this is basically kind of a showing that really our public fishery and our private fishery are very still dependent on each other, and it works out nicely that it's a peace sign like this, but it's one of those, I think it's kind of why our industry and our aquaculture folks and our private folks all get along, is because they're independent and a lot of times they're the same folks. So it's one of the good things about Virginia. I'll go through these real quick, but this is what you know, that shell volume that we're talking about, and this is all the spat set throughout all the rivers that we monitor. And you've seen this before, but it's sort of good to keep in mind. Here's 5 liters, you know, five of these in a square meter right there. And you can see these lines, right, these dots are the number of spat per square meter. You can kind of see you don't really consistently get super high spat counts until you get above that, and then you get really high spat counts right sort of right at that 10 liters, and that's what we ideally want to keep all of our public ground at, so that when the spat is there, you know, you're getting 400 or 500, I mean, in some years over 1,000, basically every piece of oyster shell there is covered in spat. But you can't, there's basically just not enough of shell on the bottom to support a heavy spat set once you get below that 5 liters per meter squared. So that's really what the whole replenishment program is about. Same thing 2016, 2017. So with your harvest seasons that you have there, so the first one, sort of my reasoning behind this, so we can kind of go through it right quick there. Just keep this in mind. This is sort of what I would pose for all the seasons. So the major takeaways here are the 8-bushel limit for hand scrape and dredge. So basically still keep the 16 per boat, 2-person per boat limit on hand scrape and dredge. I would propose a 10-bushel limit for patent tongs throughout the season, just to sort of incentivize people getting into that fishery. And it's potentially, and we can argue about it a little bit, but you can look at the numbers on deep rock, and you can see that area has been actively worked, and the numbers are going up. We've had to add very little shell to those areas, so it's working out in these areas. So I would propose that 10-bushel limit for patentong areas.
Is that 2 years, though?
What's that?
Is that 20 to the boat?
20 to the boat, yep. And then right now we have a 12-bushel limit for handtong, just in the James River, and it's 8 everywhere else. And for consistency, and on the seaside, there used to not be a limit at all, and I don't think people are catching 12 bushels now. So I would make that sort of consistently 12-bushel limit for handtong across the board. And you know, we can discuss it at some point, but I think in terms of damage to the rock, in terms of losing the shell source, if you're dredging or scraping poorly, you're going to be damaging the rock more than if you're patentonging or handtonging. So there's potential to do more damage with a heavy scrape or a heavy dredge than there is with a proper patentong or handtonging. So that's sort of why that would be there like that, in terms of the cost of replenishment. Most of our replenishment dollars go into the hand scrape areas, so that's sort of a little bit of the background behind that, as well as sort of encouraging people to get into those other fisheries there.
Could there be some effort to make sure we're using legal patent tongs as we go forward in this?
Yep, no.
I mean, that is an issue. I mean, you've got folks using clam tongs that are competing with someone like Ernie using oyster tongs.
Yeah, no, and if there's any, give me a call. I can forward it. You can talk to Marine Police, and that's something that we look at, and that's in the move there.
It was 100 pounds. I imagine it still is.
Thank you all.
Major Tom.
That's including all chain and rope.
I got some of the malls and some of the colorful built down there.
So this is the first proposed, these are all proposed draft seasons, but sort of what I'd like to do in this season, in the month of October here, is I have the hand scrape season starting in the middle of October. I know there's concerns that, you know, we need oysters in October, and there's also concern that, you know, those first 2 weeks, the quality is the worst. Whether you're optimizing your harvest there or not, you know, that's questionable. There's a lot of people that still would be crabbing then, and sort of the crabs are really pretty good in October there. So in terms of the watermen having something to do, October's a good month for crabbing in terms of the numbers, not necessarily always the price. And the same sort of concept that we worked with last year in terms of having multiple areas open in October to sort of spread out there. So I think it worked out relatively well last year. The fleet stayed pretty well split the entire season. I think that was a success that you guys helped put together with your recommendations there. So I think that worked out well. And I'd like to imitate that again this year if possible. Same thing with the Patentong area. I mean, we haven't looked at Area 8 so recently after this rain, so there could be a little death there. I don't have any hard information on that, but we have a little time to sort of readjust if need be. But I'd like to have that area again, like Area 7 was last year, open to Patentong first. Same thing, a Patentong season there in Area 3. And then Patentong, Deep Rock, the normal December, February season there. Same thing throughout this season in terms of having hand scrape areas, multiple areas open all month. The one kind of difference from the other seasons is sort of February is usually when a lot of the market demand, if you will, drops off. And we've done it before, I think last in 2014, where we sort of had a little bit of a March season when it picks back up again. You usually don't have that ice concern. This could potentially alleviate any of the requests that we have if ice is a factor, because we'll have a little bit of a two-week March season already planned if we do get a really cold winter. And again, in March, have three areas open. I know, Don, did you ever make it in the call there? No, our Saxis contingent there isn't on the call, but this year we did plant shell up in the upper Pocomoke in 9-10, and I would propose a two-week season in October there in Area 9 in the upper Pocomoke, and again sort of at the end of the season there in those areas to keep that sort of spread out so that, you know, the end of the season and the beginning of the season, there's areas open, you know, in all sort of three of the major oystering areas there. Everything else sort of follows the normal rotation, if you will, there with Great Comico. This would be the area that we split in half, so the second area opening up this year in Great Comico. Blackberry Hangs would sort of stay the same with the two-week season. drop the cone out of the hand tong season for this due to our shell planting there on Big Bar. I think I'm not sure if we haven't had a chance to get out there yet, but we talked about potentially some other areas.
I know there's a couple areas that haven't been open for a while in the Ocomica, I think, okay. We could get a little production off of.
Look at that. But basically everything else sort of stays the same there for the most part. The one change in the Tangier Pocomoke area is the Pocomoke Sound hasn't really rebounded from its high point there. It's sort of 11, 12. So that particular area, I mean, they were out there till right up till 2 o'clock in the areas of the Pocomoke the last 2 years. So I think that particularly towards the end of the season. So I would sort of suggest shortening just the Pocomoke part of Area 2 to the Shell Rock area by a month. I think Tangier could open up, and a lot of that Eastern Shore non-Tangier crowd is over on the Western Shore anyway at that time. That would sort of give that a little bit of a rest that I think is needed, particularly since we have planted Area 9 and 10. So if we do get a set there, that'll hopefully get onto the shell that are further down the in the dredge areas in Tangier and Pocono, and there'll be more shell there if we don't grind it to bits with a 3-month season there this year. So that's sort of the reasoning behind this season. This is sort of the second area, and this is sort of more similar to what we had this year in terms of the opening. In the James River area, I believe last year we had extended all the way to February, and we have a post-harvest survey, and I can get into the numbers on that if you want, but I think there was some discussion and some debate on whether or not that would be too long, and I think it was just a little bit long this year. So, I mean, 4 months split between the two areas, so Area 2 was open, or Area 1 was open first, so that's the lower side of the river there, I guess, so on this side of the channel last year. So basically split the river the same way we did last year and switched the opening order between Area 1 and 2, divided down the channel line there in the James, and keep it sort of a little bit tighter season at 4 months. And same thing, you have an area in the James, an area in the Rappahannock open, and same thing on that Patentong area there to sort of keep potentially some folks from getting into this great fishery and staying Patentong all season. It didn't quite happen last year. That was sort of our intent when we all laid out that season, but I think things were so good up there after they'd Patentonged in Area 6 and 7 that they just switched right to scraping and stayed there, a lot of the boats up there. So this year, with potentially that up limit and having an area come online there a little further down, hopefully keep a few more folks in the Patentong fishery there through the year. Same thing, sort of the normal kind of rotation, just a little bit of adjustment there in the Rappahannock. On this one, I just have, since we're not doing the 2-week split season, sort of condensed the public round 9 axis there to sort of coincide with sort of the end of dredge season there in the Poconos. So I'll give a little something else if people are wanting to stay over on that side, then they have an area to work right there in January without having the concern of, all the Pocomoke shut down there and everyone piles into Area 9 there. And, we did plant shell there, but that still could get overworked. So that's sort of the reasoning behind this season there. This is sort of the third one. This is basically what I was talking about there when I began, of sort of potentially transitioning some areas to less efficient gear types. I know October is one of those months that we need oysters, but the quality's poor. A lot of private ground folks are out, and it's one of those, everyone wants oysters. Everyone sort of, if they're not making it on crabs, they're looking forward to the October season. But if we actually do give October a try at some point and see what kind of catch we're getting when all that's open is Hantong and Patentong areas, and Area 8, pending further investigation after the freshets that we've had, I would potentially see what came out of there, what it looked like after just Patentongs were up there. You'd actually have a comparison of, okay, we know what this looked like after it was scraped. We know what it looks like after Patentong. We could actually come back after our survey and see what this area in the upper Rappahannock that was a Patentong looked like compared to a scrape area. So we could actually have a natural experiment, if you will, and kind of have that question of what the bottom looked like, what the spat set was. So that's sort of the reasoning behind that. And that actually would give you an extra month, potentially, of Patentonging into March there. And I'm a little flexible on that there. And then basically, I know that a lot of these areas in the James and the Rappahannock that you could hand tong on, I have them there. I know a lot of them are deep, aware that not everyone can get out there with a 24 set of shaft tongs, but it's one of those, if you want to try, you could. I don't think it would affect the scrape fishery that would come along afterwards, and it would give us an opportunity to look at and see what kind of harvest would actually be produced if it was sort of the traditional season where all that would open would be Hantong and Patentong there, when the Virginia fishery was getting 6 million bushels a year public ground and there wasn't a whole lot of dredging and there wasn't a hand scrape, but it's a different time. So that's sort of the reasoning behind these sort of three seasons, and I know it's a lot here for this meeting, but it's something to sort of think about and come back to there in August and further advise. So, are there any?
Can I ask you a question, Andrew? How much difference was it by how many more boats did we have by dropping the three head on the boat?
I mean, really not more than a handful here and there.
That's what I figured.
Right now, I mean, the number of, I mean, really negligible, I would say.
Everybody says there will be a lot more new boats, but I didn't think it would be.
I think that a lot of that third guy.
I think it helped us. Mm-hmm. Helped the ones doing it.
Anybody else in a comment? Anybody in the audience like to? I'm sorry, Mr. Kellen.
Andrew, we looked at it last year. I would, all three proposals have Great Wicomico open in November. I think the majority of the watermen and certainly the majority of the buyers would rather see that shifted down. You know, that resource is in such bad shape early on that, you know, if we could look at December and January like we've done historically for years, I think we changed it to that last year. That seems to work well.
As long as we can kind of shift around some of these, as long as there's spread out areas there and we're not stretching it out too much. But I think that would be in all those areas, that would be open to that. Yeah.
I mean, basically the only guys working up there now are the guys that live there, and so many of them are on Menhaden boats that with the quota situation, most of them don't ever start until December anyway. So it.
Any other comments? Questions? Would anybody in the audience have something to say about anything we've discussed this evening?
You want to stay early?
Can't believe it. Any, all right, Mr. Button, we appreciate all the hard work that you've done to give us all this information. It's very insightful, and what day would you like for us to come back?
We could take sort of I think that sort of second week in August, I think, would probably work out.
Give us a date.
The best, I think, like Wednesday again?
No. Well, the problem is we have a monthly meeting for the Watermen's Association on the second Wednesday. I mean, it doesn't affect a lot of people, but some it does. If we could make it a Tuesday or Thursday.
What about the 15th, the following week?
I had to cancel tonight.
Did you hear what he said? You could make it to Wednesday the following week on the 15th.
Okay, that'd be great. Okay.
Mm-hmm. No, we would. You're talking about the 8th. I was speaking of the 15th of August.
Yeah, the 15th of August. Yeah.
Okay.
Would that be?
That's good.
That'd be the third.
The third Wednesday there. Would that work for?
Yep.
Folks,
that's good.
Okay. So I'll tentatively sort of get us down for then. That'll give us time for the August commission meeting and. You know, we also have another commission meeting in September too, so it gives us another chance before opening day there, so to speak. But,
that's right.
So it's good that we started early. Appreciate
explain the program to them.
Yeah. What's that?
Explain the program to them.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you all for coming. It's very appreciated. Motion to adjourn.
At 4 o'clock, same time.
Andrew.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, you do that?
Yes, sir.